from WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Republican candidates have been attracting big crowds across the country, but they're not firing up African-American voters with their message of small government and conservative values. And it doesn't help that Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Perry have all had to defend themselves against charges of racism for what they've said and done. This hour, On Point, why African-Americans don't vote Republican. You can join the conversation. Why has the GOP message not caught on with African Americans? What should the Republican candidates for president do to woo black voters? Joining us now from New York is Charlton McElwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. He's also co-author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns. Hi, Professor.
Hi, Bob. Good to be with you.
Also joining us from New York, Ron Christie, GOP strategist and president of Christie Strategies. He was an informal strategist to Mitt Romney during his last run for president. He was former deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and a special assistant to George W. Bush. He's author of Acting White, The Curious History of a Racial Slur, and Black in the White House, Life Inside George W. Bush's West Wing. Ron Christie, good day to you.
Bob, pleasure to join you.
Professor McElwain, let's start with you. You've talked about the GOP having a credibility crisis with black voters. What do you mean by that? Tell us.
Well, I think it's that when the GOP candidates and other officials come out and say, look, we want to recruit more African-Americans to the Republican Party, I think many African-Americans look and say, there's nothing for me there. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, I think that they see when GOP folks are talking about African-Americans, a lot of times they tend to be talking down to them. So when you bring up the statements by Santorum or Gingrich or any of the number of candidates in the current field talking about, African-Americans needing to sort of be more schooled about work and jobs rather than welfare and so forth. And so I think a lot of African-Americans look and say, look, every time a GOP candidate is talking about us, they're talking about us in a negative, denigrating way. The second and the more important one, though, I think, is that African-Americans look and say, what does the GOP offer me in terms of offering me access and influence with my government and serving the interests of me and my community? And I think that many African-Americans don't see the GOP making a big enough case that they have an agenda, a plan, a set of policies that benefits them and their interests directly.
Ron Christie, weigh in here. Do you think the Republican message appeals to voters across the board? And specifically, does it appeal to black voters?
Well, I think it should. I think the Republican brand and the conservative brand in the last 10 to 15 years has stressed strong personal empowerment, the value and the purpose of an education, and being self-reliant and independent and certainly not needing the government to be there for a handout. I think where a disconnect comes is that a number of black folks over the years have looked at the GOP's efforts as being clumsy. And I'm the first to admit that. I think we have a long way to go. I think what the GOP needs to stress is why our message, our philosophy, and our viewpoint is a strong one, not just for people of color, but for all of America.
What are the GOP candidates not getting?
Well, I think there is a reticence on part of some of them to engage communities of color in particular. When I used to work for former Senator George Allen, I used to tell him, don't talk to black people like black people. Talk to folks as constituents, people that you're asking for the vote, and ask them what's on your mind, what's important to you, and tell them what your philosophy, your governing style and structure would be and why that would be beneficial to these individuals, not just based on the color of their skin, but for the communities that you would represent that they live in. And I think that's been a large disconnect. GOP candidates have had a difficult time over the last several years of connecting with people of color, but I think it's something that we can very easily overcome through sustained effort and outreach.
What do you say to black leaders who might say, I have been listening to the message from the GOP candidates, especially the GOP candidates for president, and it doesn't feel inclusive to me?
Well, I guess it depends on what your definition of inclusive is. If you're looking for an America that should be number one in the world based on our economy, based on our education, based on our sense of American exceptionalism, I think that would appeal to folks regardless of the color of their skin. I think when you use the term black leaders, it only denotes that people of color can only set strategies or a viewpoint for other people of color, and I think that's where we go wrong. I think that President Obama has shattered a ceiling that I'd never thought would have been shattered in my lifetime of having the first African-American president, and I'm very proud of him for that. But he doesn't preside over black or white America. He presides over the United States of America, and that's where I take a little bit of exception.
All right, let's walk through some of the statements or the missteps by the Republican candidates for president in 2012. First, Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich called President Obama the best food stamp president in American history. At a January 6th town hall meeting in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, ahead of the New Hampshire presidential primary, Gingrich had some advice for African Americans.
I'm prepared, if the NAACP invites me, I'll go to their convention and talk about why the African American community should demand paychecks and not be satisfied with food stamps.
All right, and now Rick Santorum. In recent weeks, Santorum has tried to distance himself from this comment he made at a campaign stop in Sioux City, Iowa, back on January 2nd.
I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money and provide for themselves and their families.
Professor McElwain, do you view these as just unfortunate slips, or in your mind, is there something more insidious going on here?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've generally tried to keep away from saying that these types of statements are intentional, because the truth of the matter is I cannot know that. I don't know what's going on in Santorum's or Newt Gingrich's mind or heart when they make these statements. But what I can say is that it's very curious that when you get to a mostly white state like New Hampshire or Iowa, you have Republican candidates who find it necessary to start talking about African Americans and why they are the particular drain on the economy and why they are failures of work and self-reliance and responsibility are what are lacking. And so I think that what happens is candidates know or have a sense that there are certain things that rile up the Republican base. And whether intentional or not, these sort of implicit appeals to racial stereotypes, the longstanding stereotypes that we've had about African Americans come into play. And they tend to come out in the discourse in unfortunate ways.
All right, a couple more incidents, so to speak, and then Ron Christie, I'll get you to weigh in. One of the most inflammatory moments of the campaign so far occurred when it also came out earlier that Rick Perry's family had a hunting lodge known as Niggerhead. The word is actually painted on a rock at the entrance to the camp. When asked about it, Perry quickly called the word an offensive name that has no place in the modern world. And let's hear about Ron Paul, who's been criticized for newsletters containing racist remarks published under his name back in the 1980s and 1990s. On December 21st, in an interview with CNN, Paul denied that that was his writing.
We talked about this twice yesterday at CNN. Why don't you go back and look at what I said yesterday on CNN and what I've said for 20-some years. It's 22 years ago. I didn't write them. I disavow them. That's it.
And now Rick Santorum again. During the ABC and Yahoo News Republican presidential debate at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire on January 6th, the former Pennsylvania senator downplayed what he said was a pejorative term used by President Obama and his Republican opponent, former Massachusetts governor, now the front runner in the GOP race, Mitt Romney.
The governor used a term earlier that that I shrink from, and it's one that I don't think we should be using as Republicans, middle class. There are no classes in America. We are a country that don't allow for titles. We don't put people in classes. Maybe middle-income people. But the idea somehow or another we're going to buy into the class warfare arguments of Barack Obama is something that should not be part of the Republican lexicon. That's their job. Divide.
Ron Christie, Santorum essentially says that class warfare should not be part of the GOP lexicon. But do you think it is?
I don't think it is, and I think he's absolutely right. I think there is no place in our American political system to divide Americans based on class or race. I think when we talk about saying that the rich should pay more and, you know, making a class warfare distinction, an argument is an unfortunate one. If you look at a percentage of income, the upper income brackets of the United States, they pay a majority, overwhelming majority of the taxes. I think what we need to talk about, what we need to focus on is how can we empower all Americans? And going back to the statements that we just listened to, you know, I've known Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum for over 21 years, and I can definitely tell you from my experience, my interaction, I don't think those gentlemen are racist, but certainly their comments are most unfortunate. And that's the most polite way I can put it. I think when you talk about black folks being on welfare, you talk about black folks needing a paycheck rather than receiving a welfare check, I think the professor's right. It conjures up sort of a inferiority complex somehow that blacks aren't able to compete. What they should have said and what they should have focused on is the fact that African-American unemployment in the United States is at 15.8% as opposed to the overall, say, 8.5%. The Caucasian unemployment rate for those who have a college education is much less than that. We need to focus on empowering those that don't have the means, the opportunity, or the tools to compete in the 21st century America to receive those tools, regardless of the color of their skin. And when you have Republican candidates making those comments, I think it's very easy to look at those in a racial way. But as it relates to Governor Perry and Ron Paul, here's where I absolutely draw the line. And I think both of their comments are way out of bounds and something I think we can talk about momentarily.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about African Americans and the GOP. We're talking this hour with Charlton McIlwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at NYU. He's co-author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns, and with Ron Christie, GOP strategist and president of Christie Strategies. He was an informal strategist to Mitt Romney during his 2008 bid for president. He's author of Acting White, The Curious History of a Racial Slur. We have lots of comments on our website, lots of phone callers lining up waiting to talk to both of you gentlemen. First, a web comment from onpointradio.org from Jemley, who says, "You've got to ask why black voters don't flock to the GOP. The question I'd ask is why on earth 12% do? You could also ask why gay people should vote Republican, or why single mothers or non-believers or people who value science or education or unemployed people or people dependent on Medicare or Social Security should vote Republican. Ask every group that the Republicans disparage and demean and who are not part of the utopian fantasy world that Republicans want to create." You can comment as well at onpointradio.org. Professor McIlwain, let me ask you this. Do you think that the GOP candidates in this election cycle, the 2012 cycle, have alienated black voters already? Do you think it's intentional? Do you think it's insensitivity or what?
I think they have already. I think, you know, the statements that we went over in this last segment really play to that. And I think that African-American voters hear that and say, you know, we've kind of heard this song and dance before. And so I think a lot are sort of just predisposed to saying, you know what, there's nothing for me out there. And so, you know, my mind, my ears are shut. And I think much of that has to do with the candidates. You know, I think Ron had it right. It was an inability or a reticence, rather, to talk about race because I think that many of them don't know how to sort of walk the fine line and say there are issues about race that we can talk about, and here's how we talk about them. And I think the second part of that is what many Republican candidates have not quite gotten down yet.
Which is?
How do we talk about race, and particularly how do we talk about race when we have an ideology, a party, a sense that, you know, we're colorblind, that we should be colorblind. And so I think the trap that many GOP candidates find themselves in is, look, we're supposed to be colorblind. We're not supposed to be talking about race. Yet here I am on the stump talking about blacks, welfare, et cetera, and here I am talking on the stump about how I want to attract more African-Americans to the party. And I don't think that they have thought through the implications of their words of how do we attract African-Americans but speak to them, speak to their interest. Tell them what this party has for them. Tell them how they would be better off as being a member of that party, voting for members of that party. So I don't think that they've formulated an actual plan, if you will, a strategy for attracting black voters.
Ron Christie.
Well, I suppose I'd look at this from the other perspective and say, well, what have the Democrats done to attract black voters? What have Democrats done that are specifically talking to the needs of a particular community? You know, I look at this president and he was supposed to be the first post-racial president in American history, that America was no longer going to be black and white, but it was going to be red, white, and blue. But within the first month of the Obama administration, you heard the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, refer to America as a nation of cowards on race. Later that summer, you had the President of the United States say that his friend, Professor Henry Louis Gates up at Harvard University, when he'd been arrested in Cambridge, the white police officer had acted stupidly. You have the new Black Panther Party case, which has widely been perceived as being one of the most egregious violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, and yet the Holder Justice Department refuses to prosecute. And I think it gives some folks, and certainly me in particular, pause of saying, why are we not looking at race in an even-handed way? Why are we having a situation where you have the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, now saying that she's being portrayed in a new book that's out that's called Obama's by Jody. I think her last name is
Cantor.
Cantor, yes. When I read the book, and I thought it portrayed her as being a very strong, very decisive leader, and in fact, in many ways, more decisive and for certainly possessing strength than the president. So I think that we need to have a more honest discussion. I think the professor is exactly right. I think that the way to do it is to talk about issues, to talk about what are the needs of a particular community, and try to take the very polarizing aspect of I'm just appealing to blacks or they're just appealing to whites out, and let's appeal to Americans on a sense of community and our citizenship and our communal and, frankly, collective American values rather than just singling them out based on race.
Well, just so I'm perfectly clear about this, Ron Christie, are you saying Republicans should begin addressing the issues black voters want to hear about specifically or that they should address them in a colorblind way?
Well, I think when you address the needs of Americans in a very, very difficult economic situation, that takes care of black folks, white folks, and people in between. I just have a very difficult time of saying we should pursue a black agenda. What on earth is a black agenda as opposed to a white agenda?
Well, you know, black agenda, white agenda, whatever you want to call it, here's the real fact, which is that many African Americans see years of slavery, injustice, Jim Crow segregation, so forth, patterns of discrimination that are historical and that have current ramifications. And many look and say, you know, the GOP, once the Civil Rights Act in the 60s were passed, said, look, you know, we're colorblind now. The law says that we're all equal. Our job is done. And I think that that's where the GOP's reticence to talk about race or talk about racial issues or issues affecting African-Americans or other people of color directly comes from. But here you have African-Americans that look and say, look, the discrimination that we have faced historically as a group over years that still continues, look at the overwhelming numbers of African-Americans that fell prey to the predatory lending and the housing market and that crisis over recent years. They look at that form of discrimination and say, how can you say that the law, that the free market is colorblind? And what is your message to me that says, let's get rid of government, that let's get rid of government protections for people like me who may fall prey to this kind of thing? And I think that type of message is simply not effective when you have African Americans who say, look, it's my race that for so often was the subject and the point of discrimination that so much often is currently, and it's my race today that really informs my political interest.
Professor McElwain, Ron Christie, hang on for a few minutes. Let's bring a few more voices to the program. Let's speak to some On Point listeners. Angela's calling us from Indianola, Mississippi. Hi, Angela. Weigh in.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
Good. I am a black female from Mississippi, and I am a journalist as well, and I've been doing my own research on Democrats and Republicans, and we have been taught systematically to believe that Republicans are bad. Okay? Now, if you want to start to win people over to the Republican Party, first you can start off by telling everybody, hey, Martin Luther King was initially a Republican, and he won us over, black, when I say us, won us over to the Democratic Party. He and Kennedy, and they were both assassinated after the fact. But my thing is, the real leaders in our community go unheard. We are unpopular. And it's just so much I can say about it. And you say, you know, we say we are Christians. The Republican platform is more Christian than the Democrat. They believe in abortion. They believe in gays being married. Now the gays want to be divorced. It's so much, and they also gave us the welfare state. I myself am on Section 8, and I'm not speaking against it, but it is so hard. Republicans teach you to work for yourself. Our people don't even know what a FICO score is, okay? It's just so much that we are missing out on as a black people, and it's heartbreaking because the Democrats sit back. Benny Thompson just ran an ad not too long ago here saying, hey, if you don't vote for this Democratic guy who's running for office, they're going to put you back in the cotton fields. See, these are things that go unheard of in Mississippi, and it's still going on. Democrats evoke fear into us, and they give us welfare. I'm even told now that if you're going to be on welfare, you need to, you're going to have to get on some birth control if you want to get TANF, things like this.
So,
and I'm an editor-in-chief of my own online magazine.
So,
these are things that need to be heard and talked about in the black community.
So Angela, are you saying that Republicans are missing a wide-open opportunity?
Oh, yes. They need to step in, man. The time is now. And the reason I say that is because with this Haley Barbour issue going on, and I'm not trying to capitalize on that, but with this Haley Barbour issue going on, we say we're Christians, this is the Bible Belt. It is time for the Republicans to stand up, come to his rescue, and say, okay, you believe in forgiveness. Okay, so what? Racist comments have been made. Racist slurs. Okay, we all have been taught to hate each other. But you know, it's a God that sits high and looks low, and he knows our heart. And sitting here in Indianola, Mississippi, I see nice-looking white guys. But we dare not mix and mingle.
All right.
You know why? Because of the stigmatism. I believe Republicans need to step up right now and take advantage of what's going on in Mississippi. They need to come to Mississippi and start recruiting from here.
All right, Angela, I think we got it. She's talking, when she mentions former Governor Haley Barbour, she's talking about his controversial pardon of 208 murderers, drug dealers, and other prisoners on down the line on his last day in office. Let's take another call from Carl, who's dialing us from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on Point.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to start out saying that Ron, about 95% of the things that you say on commentary and everything, I fundamentally disagree with, but I have to respect the strength that you have to be a black person in the Republican Party. There's no doubt about that. In that area, I have no problem with you know, confirming that you have me beat on the strength meter right there. As far as the Republican Party, basically ever since 1965, they have committed themselves to winning the white majority and everybody else pretty much be damned in that path. And then the candidates this year, God bless them. You can't be too mad at them because they're only playing a familiar playbook that they have. And they don't know any better. This is the playbook that they have, the playbook that they've ran for 47 years. And if you're going to ask these people to change right in mid-game, they can't do it.
Carl, how do you see this this flock of GOP candidates, the 2012 candidates, writing off the black community?
I beg your pardon?
You essentially said that the Republican Party has written off the black community. How do you see this crop of GOP candidates this time around writing off the black vote?
In their rhetoric, the food stamp president, the inner city. I hear all the dog whistles that's thrown out there to the white Republican base. But the problem is that they fail to realize that the demographics has changed in America. You can't win national elections anymore with just the white evangelical male Christians. I'm as conservative as anyone that you ever bring on this panel, but yet and still I feel uncomfortable, uninvited, and unwanted in the Republican Party. Every time I watch a Republican debate, I don't hear any issues to anyone that even a little bit resemble me. At the Republican convention, I feel uninvited, unwanted. You know, no need to apply whenever I watch it. But me, as a civic-minded American, I feel that it's my civic duty to watch every debate, Republican or Democratic debate, or watch both of the convention and the speeches, because that's what I think that I'm supposed to do as a civic-minded American.
If only more people did that, Carl, we'd all be better off. But let me ask you this question. What is it you want to hear from the Republican candidates?
It's not what I want to hear. This is one of the 5% that I agree with Ron. I agree that they should stick to the issues of Americans. It's not what I want to hear. It's what I don't want to hear. What I don't want to hear is welfare queens. What I don't want to hear is inner city youth not having job ethics or work ethics because no one teaches them work ethics. That's just fundamentally wrong. I don't want to hear that the majority of black people are on welfare and on food stamps when we know that's just not the truth. It's not what I want to hear. It's what I don't want to hear.
Carl, thank you very much for speaking on Point today from Nashville, Tennessee. Professor McElwain, weigh in here.
I think he has a lot of good things to say, both he and Ron, in talking about this particular approach of Republicans to race, the idea of talking about Americans, talking about us despite color and so forth. I think there's a vast difference in talking about creating policies that are specifically based on race, and a very different thing to say. And this has really been Obama's approach, and it's the approach that he's taken that's, he's gotten a lot of flack for from a lot of African-American leaders, which is to say, here is a policy that affects many Americans, all Americans. But now that I'm here with you talking to African-American people, let me tell you how this particular policy affects you specifically. This is how it makes your world, your daily life better as an African-American in whatever situation that they are.
Well, let me ask you to be specific. If you were putting together a GOP agenda designed to address the issues that black voters care about, and I assume issues that all voters would care about, give me the top thing that it would be saying.
In today's world, I think it would have to be jobs. Okay, so if I'm taking the Republican position and saying, first of all, we need to lower taxes on the top wage earners, the top income earners of the country, and lowering those taxes will spill over into more jobs being created. Then if that's the policy and that's a position, then if I'm amongst a group of African Americans worried about where I'm going to have and whether I'm going to have opportunities for jobs and more jobs, I've got to say this is how this particular policy of cutting taxes on the rich will translate into you and people in your community having better opportunities to find employment.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about African Americans and the GOP. We're speaking with Charlton McElwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, co-author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns, and with Ron Christie, GOP strategist and president of Christie Strategies. He was an informal strategist to Mitt Romney during his last run for president, and he's author of Acting White, The Curious History of a Racial Slur. were. Ron Christie, let's come back to you to start this segment. And let me ask you something that one of the previous callers was trying to get at. Have black voters not taken a close enough look at the Republican Party, and have many just almost automatically written it off?
I think, unfortunately, that's the case. And I think when you look at the caller calling from Mississippi about many African-American communities have a very strong sense of religion, of community, of the values of education, these are many messages that are being preached, if you will, by the Republican Party. But I also think when you look at the demographics and you have 90-something percent of people of one particular race voting for a president, and then you have Tom Joyner, who is a very popular talk show host amongst the African-American community, saying, we need to reelect President Obama because he's black. Or when you have Al Sharpton saying, if you have an exception with the president, then you're going to hear from me. When you have folks who purport to be black leaders who are almost employing a loyalty oath to a particular individual based on the color of their skin, I think that takes us in the wrong direction. And many folks in African-American communities around the country do not want to go afoul of what the community think or the sense in the narrative is, well, if my family, if my friends and the folks in that I live and work with are voting a certain way, I sure better because I don't want to be ostracized. This is the United States of America in the 21st century. We've overcome so much that I think that we should be able to have an honest discussion about the leaders that we are electing to lead this country forward and look past the color of their skin and look at their specific vision, qualifications, and their ideological standpoint rather than we better reelect President Barack Obama because he's black. I just think that's wrong.
So then do you blame in some ways black voters for not recognizing what might be called the merits of the Republican Party?
Well, I blame folks that are unwilling or unable to look at a different ideological viewpoint based on, well, that's what white folks do. And you've mentioned in the tease that I was the author of a book called Acting White. It is incredible to me in the run-up to President Obama's election that a lot of the folks that I talked to said, oh, well, he's not authentically black. He talks a different way. He's just acting white. And then once, of course, he became the Democratic primary nominee and then eventually the president of the United States, then suddenly it's, oh, we should have a racial solidarity because he's black. So I am against those who were opposed to him for saying that he talks and acts white because he had a different upbringing than certain folks. And I'm also against those folks who would want to keep him in office just based on the color of his skin. Let his qualifications and his achievements and accomplishments in office be the true barometer of whether or not he deserves another 4 years in the White House.
All right. Let's take a comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Be the Ace writes, as an African-American man, I strongly agree with some of the principles of the Republican Party, self-help, etc., and know for certain that many of my family and my friends do also. The Republican problem is that they consistently approach the African-American community from a condescending, stereotypical position. If they really believe in the capitalist system, as most black folks do, tell them to set up a GOP small business development entity within the black community. Put your money where your mouth is, GOP. Ron Christie, respond to that.
I agree with that. I think that we have talked so much in the last 20 years about enterprise zones and economic zones. I think when we're talking about specific policies that are empowering folks and lifting folks up to from one socioeconomic level to another, these are exactly the sort of things that we should be doing. But I believe more than anything else, the true civil rights initiative of the 21st century is the power of an education, and that we've largely failed our children in inner city communities and rural communities across this country. We can do better, black, white, and all colors in between, by making sure that we have a strong education safety net and provide the resources and the tools to compete, and that will allow people to have the opportunity to go to college, to then avail themselves as business folks. But allowing our students to be shuffled from grade to grade without strong accountability, I think, is a mistake, regardless of the color of the skin in general, and particularly as it relates to our communities of color.
Kathy is calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Go right ahead.
I'm listening to this conversation, and I rarely call into programs like this, but I do listen, and I am a member here in Lansing. However, my uncle, Valores Washington, was the first minority affairs director of the RNC under President Eisenhower. He left that position very disappointed in 1965, due to the party's movement toward the Southern Strategy, which people now, vehemently deny that it existed. Well, the party at that time were just, they really disempowered this man who'd worked his entire life toward, you know, empowerment of black people. And I wish that those in the black community, especially, you know, people who have the opinion of the caller from Indianola, Mississippi. My mother's from Tylertown, Mississippi, so I'm very familiar with the culture of Mississippi. I wish that they would become more educated about what policies affect them directly. And I think the GOP, if you look at those, the history of the GOP in the last 47, 45 years does not reflect, what they say. I'm just saying the lip service has become so opposite of what their policies and the support of their policies have been. President Obama was left. He could only do what he can with what he was left with. We have treaties dating back to the Reagan administration with Saudi Arabia. He can't do anything with that. He was left with Guantanamo Bay. He can't do much with the fact that there was no evidence collected on so many people who we are afraid of letting go. You've got people like Joe Wilson, who in the chamber during President Obama's State of the Union address blatantly call him a liar. That's just a total lack of disrespect. What I would like to see is a respect for this president as we would respect any president, and a effort made to work for the American people as a whole. I could not, at this point in time, call myself a Republican and be an active member of the GOP for the reason that they don't say, what they say and what they do aren't congruent.
Kathy, thank you very much for your call. Let's take another before time runs out. Joe is on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Joe. You're on Point.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Go ahead.
To remind us all to look at history, and the caller just before me talked about the Southern strategy. White Democrats got upset in the 60s when the civil rights legislation came through, and they left the Democratic Party and joined the Republican Party. The Republican Party is a collection of angry people, angry Southerners who don't want to see black folks get ahead, angry Northerners, to some extent, blue-collar folks who have been tricked to think that some of the issues the Republican Party talks about are for them, even at the same time that the party hates unions and does everything it can do to kill unions. And the evangelicals, I mean, the Republicans are no more God-fearing than the Democrats. So you got a collection of strange bedfellows. And I think, you know, folks like Ron Christie, I see him on TV all the time. There's other friends that I have that are Republicans. Unfortunately, most of the black Republicans I know are looking to get paid. They're looking to get some money for their allegiance to the party. I don't think it's a heartfelt association. And I think the rest of America, you know, black folks aren't stupid. They know that the Republican Party, and I can tell you being here in South Carolina, the Republican Party does not want to empower black folks because they're fearful that they'll become a political force. So let's stop fooling each other. Let's be honest.
All right, Ron Christie, Charlton McIlwain. I want to look ahead here to the rest of the 2012 presidential campaign in this way. As of today, it certainly seems like Mitt Romney is headed toward the Republican presidential nomination. And I want to ask this question: does it seem to you that Romney has yet tried to woo black conservatives, Republican or Democrat, Ron Christie?
I think he has. I think he has the best chance of being elected on the Republican side of the ledger, because I think he's the one who would appeal to the so-called Reagan Democrats. He would appeal to independents. And he has aggressively thought of, how can I make specific inroads in communities of color by asking for the vote, of hearing what's on folks' minds, and then, of course, trying to implement those policies. We're still in a primary right now. I think when he starts running for the general election, should he be the nominee, he will be a very, very difficult opponent for the president to take on. But at this juncture, I think it's going to go down to the wire if it's those two men, and it will be very interesting to see the state of the economy as well as the percentage of the African-American and the Latino vote as to whether or not we'll have a new occupant in the Oval Office in January of 2013.
Charlton McElwain, your take on this.
Well, I think that one thing that Romney does have going for him if he ends up being the nominee is that he is not one of these candidates that thus far has sort of made these kinds of statements that has already discolored African-Americans' viewpoint of him. So regardless of the fact that he would have an extremely uphill battle, I think he at least more than those other candidates is poised to go out in communities of color and share that message should he choose to do so and choose that strategic tact to be able to go in and say, look, here's my particular platform. Here's the policies that I'm pushing. And as far as you and your community is concerned, this is how this will benefit you. This is how this differs from the president's policies. So he might be somewhat successful in just trying, though I think he has a very steep hill to climb.
Charlton McElwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, thank you very much for speaking to On Point today. Same to you, Ron Christie, GOP strategist and president of Christie Strategies. In a moment, on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson reflects on African-American firsts. The website, legacy.com, has a searchable database of obituaries from more than 756 newspapers across the U.S. Isabel Wilkerson, professor of journalism at Boston University's College of Communication and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, wrote an essay for the New York Times and This American Life about how hundreds of those obituaries had a phrase in common.
A single thread appears and reappears in the final words written by the families of more than 300 people who died this past year. In each of these obituaries was a phrase that read something like this: the first Black American to, or the first African American X. Eugene King was the first African American milk delivery man in the Gary, Indiana area. Eddie Coger was the first Black bus driver in the state of South Carolina. Camillus Wilson was the first African American meter reader for the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company. Nancy Hodge Snyder was said to have had, quote, the distinction of being the first Black registered nurse in Kalamazoo, Michigan, unquote. I scan the list of names and I can't stop reading. How mundane the positions are, how modest the dreams have been. But added together, they somehow bear witness to how far the country has come and how it got to where it is. They speak to how many individual decisions had to be made, how many chances taken, the anxiety and second-guessing at the precise instant that each of these people got hired to whatever humble or lofty position they sought. Walter Tharp Jr. was the first Black window dresser at Wolf and Dessauer's department store in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Walter Lee was the first Black postal clerk in Winter Park, Florida. Bernice Ellis Riley was the first Black teller at First Federal Bank in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Thomas Reed Sr. was the first African-American mold maker at Wheaton Glass in Millville, New Jersey. When they were hired, most appeared to have known they were making history. The family of Alvin Taylor of Palmetto, Florida, described him as simply, quote, the first African-American in every appointment he attained. A woman named Dorothy Allen had never heard of a Black probation officer in her county, but in 1974 she applied anyway because she had a sociology degree, heard of an opening, and needed the job. Everybody knew who had which jobs, her husband Dempsey told me. There was some judge's nephew that wanted that job. We were shut out time and time again, but she went in there and she got it. They celebrated in Detroit that weekend, and decades later, he wrote the line I read in her obituary, first Black probation officer in Saginaw County, Michigan. There are influential people on the list. James Bowman was the first Black resident at St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago and the father of White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett. Annette Samuels was the first Black White House spokeswoman. Matthew Perry was the first black United States District Court judge in South Carolina. But it's the lesser-known positions that make history with a little h. The more ordinary the first, the more petty the years of exclusion seem to be in a world filled with black tellers and black postal clerks. Each position was both a happy triumph and a sad reminder of what it took to get there. Jimmy Noel Cox was the first black reserve sheriff deputy hired in Gibson County, Indiana. Donald Dickerson was the first African-American firefighter in Statesboro, Georgia. Pressy Frentress was the first black mail carrier for the Gray Iron Plant in Saginaw, Michigan. Eva McElroy was the first African-American voter precinct inspector in San Jose, California. Marjorie Grievous was the first African-American female licensed funeral director and embalmer in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Sometime in the future, the phrase will be invoked in the obituary for the biggest first of all, the first African-American elected to the Oval Office. It's a designation that surely the first milk delivery man and the first electrician and the first African-American business agent for Union Local 663 had more than a little something to do with.
Isabel Wilkerson is professor of journalism at Boston University's College of Communication and is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns. She herself is the first black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in journalism. You can read her essay on our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Medina Roshan and Lucas Shepner. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Sorry, Karen. I'm Bob Oakes, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.